This is Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Maintaining bone strength is complex with no single solution. My patients who want to optimize their bone health have seen remarkable results with LiveMD as part of a comprehensive bone program. LiveMD is a Class 1 medical device cleared by the FDA. It creates a gentle, low-intensity vibration to benefit your musculoskeletal system. It's a safe, scientifically proven, and simple approach to maintaining musculoskeletal health and wellness. It really works, just 10 minutes per day. Go to livemd.us, that's livemd.us, to learn more about how LiveMD may improve your health. That's livemd.us. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today I'm going to discuss something that I've been looking very much forward to talking about. Haven't talked about it yet on Intelligent Medicine, but we're going to talk about a modality, a therapy, that I think is going to assume increasing importance in our armamentarium of natural therapies for treatment of diseases, because what could be more natural than oxygen? It's the very stuff of the staff of life, the stuff that we breathe. And there is a increasingly popular medical therapy called hyperbaric oxygen. And today we're going to talk to an expert. Dr. Scott Scher is a medical advisor to the Hyperbaric Medical Solutions, which has locations in the tri-state area,
three locations in New York.
And it's a really, they're pioneering the use of hyperbaric oxygen for some of the traditional conditions that it's been used for, but also exploring some very exciting investigational applications of this versatile therapy. Dr. Scher is a board-certified internal medicine physician. He's a graduate of UCLA, and then he attended the University of Maryland Medical School. And he is a member of the Undersea and Hyperbaric Medical Society. It's actually the way this got started is in diving medicine. We'll talk a little bit about that. He is unique in that he's one of the few medical doctors in the country using an integrative approach to hyperbaric care. So not just applying the oxygen, but trying to apply it in the context of a rational program for healing various types of medical challenges. So without further ado, here's Dr. Scher. It's a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine.
Well, very happy to be here today. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so tell us a little bit about the background on this condition, on this treatment. It's not new. Hyperbaric oxygen's been going on for a long time, and actually it's the standard therapy for diving injuries, and this is something that you've been trained in. Explain that.
Well, so the society, the Undersea Hyperbaric Medical Society, as you mentioned, that I belong to, it began as a result of therapy for diving injury, or also otherwise known as decompression illness.
Or the bends.
Now, the bends, yes, otherwise known as the bends, right? And the bends has been known about for a long time. Most impressively described during the building of the Brooklyn Bridge back in the 1880s.
Right.
And I think about 120 people died, and most of them happened because of the bends, actually, because what happened was they were sinking their actual workers down deep below the earth, well, actually below the water, of course, and they were actually building the pylons, building the piece of the bridge that the bridge actually stands on over the water. And those guys had to be actually put in compressed air environments. And compressed air actually has been around since the 1600s. It was invented by a clergyman back then where he had these organ bellows and he just attached them to this closed, sealed chamber and either sucked air out or pumped air in. And it was basically called a hyperbaric or hypobaric environment, H-Y-P-E-R or H-Y-P-O environment. And that's actually used in a number of different ways, therapeutically and otherwise, without much research or data, up until the bridge-building episodes that I mentioned. And at that point, they were noticing that if these guys came up very quickly from being under the surface of the water, they got these severe symptoms, severe pain, discomfort, seizures, paralysis, death. And it was described at that time as called the bends. And it was not until maybe about the 1930s that we were able to actually get oxygen concentrated enough to put it into chambers or to put it into canisters. But what they found was initially back in the 1880s and even before that was that if these guys went back underneath the surface of the water, back into these what they call caissons, all their symptoms went away. So diving medicine kind of took a leap forward with 100% oxygen being able to be concentrated, and also when the military got involved at that time as well, when they realized that not only would it help if they put them under back under those same conditions that they just came out of, but also if using 100% oxygen instead of just compressed air. The difference being that compressed air has other things in it than just oxygen, like nitrogen mostly, and that's the main cause of decompression illness actually is nitrogen bubbles. So allowing someone to go into 100% oxygen environment, also giving them the pressure that they had by being underwater, resolved their symptoms. And then it was basically after the 1930s that the medical uses of hyperbaric therapy exploded. I guess not necessarily right away. The first couple were carbon monoxide exposure and a couple of severe infections. And that all happened in the 1960s, and that's actually when the Undersea and Hyperbaric Medical Society was born.
So they're actually, in terms of conditions that are treatable with hyperbaric oxygen therapy, they sort of divided into two categories. The conditions that are recognized and approved and traditional, and we'll talk about those first, and then there are the investigational conditions, the right. New applications, which I think are even more intriguing. But let's start with some of the basics. We know that oxygen is very healing. It helps to heal wounds. So describe the role of hyperbaric oxygen. These are, by the way, these are approved by the FDA and covered by insurance generally, right?
Right. Covered by all major insurers, Medicare included. I think the key to understanding hyperbaric therapy is to understanding what we're doing. And I think, as you mentioned in the beginning, it's all about oxygen. Not just actually all about oxygen, though, in some ways, because you also need pressure, right? And that's what hyperbaric therapy is doing. You're doing two things at the same time. You're increasing the amount of oxygen, and you're increasing the pressure. And they go together, because to allow your body to increase the amount of oxygen in circulation requires not only 100% oxygen that you breathe, but actually the pressure to drive that oxygen into the body. And that happens not through the red blood cells, which are the most common type of cell that carries oxygen in our body, but also the plasma, or the liquid of our blood.
So literally, you're kind of amping up the oxygen-carrying capacity of the blood, because it usually relies on the carrying of the red blood cells, but literally you almost solubilize the oxygen in the liquid part of the blood, and then it gets everywhere, deep into the body.
Right, it's pure physics. It's something called Henry's Law. The more oxygen that you have in circulation or in the air, and the more pressure you put on it, the more of that oxygen is going to go into liquid form. And in some treatments, we're getting up to 1,200% more oxygen into circulation than we can just by breathing at sea level. So it's the oxygen concentration in the blood that allows this cascade of things to happen in the body. And wound healing is one of the big things that we do, like you mentioned. A number of other things as well, decreasing inflammation, increasing blood vessel growth, stem cell production from the bone marrow, revving up the mitochondria in our cells, which are the workhorses, the power of our cells that make energy. And this is just a few of the many reasons why hyperbaric therapy works. But to back to your question regarding the FDA-approved indications, the most common ones that we treat are basically twofold, the ones that can be treated only in a hospital and the ones that can be treated outside of the hospital. And the ones in the hospital are pretty dramatic, the biggest one being carbon monoxide poisoning. I did my training in Baltimore, as you mentioned, and I saw patients that were not breathing on ventilators go in with carbon monoxide poisoning and come out walking and talking.
Especially at those long, cold winters where they use all kinds of contraptions improperly to heat cold tenements in the poor housing stock of deteriorating Baltimore.
Yeah, Baltimore has some of that, that's for sure. And so I saw some pretty amazing things, and that's how I got involved in hyperbaric therapy, just from a from a philosophical, I really guess from a, just like really just getting curious about it from that exposure. And there's a couple others that are just treated in the hospital: necrotizing fasciitis, which is gasgreen or otherwise known as flesh-eating bacteria. There's a number of different other infections, but what we typically treat in the outpatient setting, and this is what I do most of the time, and what's more common is diabetic foot wounds, diabetic foot ulcers, and radiation injury. And these are patients that have had radiation for cancer treatment and have had side effects that have debilitated them or ruined or at least decreased their quality of life as a result. So those are two most common things we treat as an outpatient. There's also refractory osteomyelitis, which is refractory bone infections. There's also compromised flaps and grafts. These are typically seen in patients with plastic surgery or other types of surgical procedures there's some pending problems with the grafts themselves, and hyperbaric therapy can help heal them and help revascularize those. But of all of them, the two most common are diabetic foot ulcers and radiation injury.
So does this require like a big, gigantic piece of equipment, or can you just go into a little oxygen tent, or can you get like local therapy, say like a bag applied around your foot? How does that work?
That's a really good question. So there's a number of different types of chambers available. The most common types are called monoplace chambers, and these are single-person hard acrylic chambers. And we're talking about wound healing. We're talking about pretty deep pressures you can't get in different types of chambers, which I'll mention in a second. So there's the monoplace chambers, which are the single person chambers. Those are hard chambers. There's the multiplace chambers, which are multi people chambers. Of course, you could have many people in at the same time. Those are also hard chambers. And then you also have what's called soft hyperbaric or mild hyperbaric oxygen therapy chambers. Mm-hmm. And those are the plastic sort of tent chamber that you're mentioning.
Right.
And the only really indication for those chambers at this point that's FDA approved is acute mountain sickness. So if you go up high on a mountain, you get sick, you can go into one of those chambers and your symptoms will get better. Although there may be some indications for those down the line, at this point, most of the therapy has been centered on both the mono and the multi-place chambers.
So the tents are actually things maybe that mountaineers will use, like at base camp, trying to climb Mount Everest. I mean, that actually helps you restore you after a bout of hypo-oxygenation. Is that the idea?
Yeah, because what they're doing in the soft chambers is they're compressing air. Instead of compressing oxygen, and you're doing it to about 1.3 atmospheres of pressure.
And that's not that much.
No, it's about 15 feet of seawater by equivalent. And that actually, that's probably enough for the people that are climbing mountains. And there are some indications on the, I guess what you call the investigational side or the off-label side in hyperbaric therapy, that type of therapy may be helpful for. But for wound healing, peripheral wound healing outside of the central nervous system, you need deeper pressures. You need something around 2 atmospheres or 2.4, which is 45 feet of seawater, which equivalent. And the idea with the seawater, just so everybody understands, is that what we're doing in the chamber is we're simulating the pressure it feels to be underwater. So you don't feel like you're underwater, but all the water when you're diving 45 feet below sea level or below the sea is exerting a pressure on you, and we're just modulating that or simulating that in the chamber. And that's what we're doing for peripheral wound healing type of indications, and diabetic foot ulcers and radiation injury usually fall into those categories. Diabetics, unfortunately, hyperbaric therapy is vastly underutilized. I've had many patients over the years that have come in with an amputation already that very well, at least there was a high likelihood that amputation may have been prevented if they had used hyperbaric therapy the time before.
And so this is more than just a bag applied around the foot. It really has to be, the whole body has to be within the chamber so that you really drive oxygen deep within the tissue, correct?
Yes, sir, because it happens through the lungs. So the way the oxygen transfer happens is not through the skin, but through the lungs. So it's the transition of carbon dioxide and oxygen in the lungs that cause the effects on the body, basically. So you need to have your whole body within the chamber to get the effects of hyperbaric therapy, yes.
So I have to ask this question because there are some concerns about high intensity oxygen therapy. So, for instance, the classic problem is that some kids who were preemies back in, I guess it was the 50s, received high-intensity oxygen therapy, and as a result, they became blind. So how do we make sure that this is entirely benign and isn't having any adverse effects on the body?
Sure. So oxygen toxicity is something that we do consider in the chambers, and but it's very uncommon, actually. And I think it's been given a name such as that you described because of some certain things that have happened in the past. But oxygen toxicity is actually very uncommon. Preemies, obviously kids, are more sensitive to oxygen exposure than adults are, actually, too. The one thing that we find with the eyes in patients is that if patients have cataracts, those cataracts may mature quicker in a hyperbaric environment. We've also noticed that patients' vision will also change in the short term, meaning that their far vision will get worse because the lens of the eye changes in the chamber. But we don't have anybody having those kind of symptoms that preemies have within the chambers now. Mm-hmm. I've never heard that being described in our literature, and it's something that we don't worry about.
And by the same token, this therapy might be good for vision problems, because when you're suffering from macular degeneration, or if you're suffering from something called central retinal artery occlusion, that's actually one of the approved indications for this. That's kind of like a blood clot in the eye where there's poor circulation.
Exactly.
If you enhance the circulation, you can save the retina from dying, parts of it, literally, right?
That's exactly right, yeah. So if there's a blockage of blood flow, the good thing about supersaturating the body with oxygen in the plasma is that a lot of times the plasma can get past blockages, and also we're diffusing oxygen much further into tissue versus just breathing sea-level oxygen, or like we typically do. Even if you have a face mask on, because you're driving that oxygen into the body. So you're allowing the body to continue to vitalize tissue, or continue to keep it vital, another way to say it, instead of it dying because of lack of blood flow. And the retinal artery occlusion is one of those examples, absolutely. And we also think for decompression illness, for instance, or for the bends, when there's a blockage of blood flow, not only is hyperbaric therapy preventing that bubble from continuing to block blood flow by actually squeezing it down, because the more pressure you put on a bubble, the less that bubble actually exists. It'll get smaller and smaller and smaller. But also there's this sort of inflammatory reaction that happens at the same time when you block blood flow, and hyperbaric therapy is going to prevent that from happening because it's allowing the body to continue to be oxygenated. So I think hopefully that makes sense.
Yeah, indeed. So actually that brings up one of the investigational conditions for which hyperbaric oxygen is sometimes touted, which is in the aftermath of strokes. I mean, clearly there's a, you know, part of the brain literally is being deprived of oxygen, tissue is dying, and it's thought that there may be a role for hyperbaric oxygen in the post-stroke patient. So talk to us about that.
Sure. I mean, as you know, I'm sure that I think it's the number three cause of death in our country, stroke, and it could be pretty devastating. And I think most of us have had family members that have had strokes or TIAs, and that's exactly what occurred. It's a blockage of blood flow, and depending on where that blockage is, it's either a large area that has a stroke or a small. And sometimes that small area can be manifest as a very large stroke, even, as happened to one of my uncles. So, you know, I understand how this happens. And what hyperbaric therapy does, as we mentioned, it prevents. So there's a couple things. The first is that there was a great study that was done in Israel back in, I think, about 2013, I believe. And they looked at patients that are 6 months post-stroke, and they used hyperbaric therapy on these patients. And they did dramatically better, both motor function, both their physical function, as well as their cognitive abilities. Now, they also noticed that the longer patients had been since they had the stroke, the less that they got better. So they did, everybody improved, but it was a gradation depending on how far along they were from their stroke, which sort of bears the question then, well, what if we gave hyperbaric therapy, you know, when the stroke occurred, right? What if we gave it in the acute setting? And the challenge with those studies is that, as you'd imagine, you don't know who's going to get better from a stroke, because some people do, and who's not going to. So it's a difficult study to actually do, but there are rumors of these things, rumors of studies similar to this trying to be get going in Israel and other locations
right.
as well.
And also there's so much fussing around with a patient that putting them in a chamber may restrict access for other types of essential therapy and monitoring, so it's kind of hard to do both at once.
Well, actually, the interesting thing, I'm sorry to interrupt, was that we actually can do a lot of the monitoring in the chamber.
They
have they can have ventilators in the chamber, they can have IVs in the chamber, and in fact, they've done studies on acute coronary syndrome or myocardial infarctions or heart attacks,
right.
And patients' outcomes are better if they go into the chamber after being revascularized. Of course, so you're not going to keep them in there before they actually get the stent that they need, but afterwards, preventing heart tissue from dying, they've noticed that the outcomes are better. So that's a pretty impressive one. There's also coronary artery bypass surgery or CABG surgery, putting patients in a hyperbaric chamber before they go on the pump, which is sort of like the artificial heart while they're getting surgery. These patients also do better neurocognitively. So, I mean, I think what it comes down to, like we've been discussing, is just the general physiology, what we're doing in a hyperbaric chamber. And that's really what kind of manifests in all these disease states or all these issues, is that we're increasing the amount of oxygen in the blood. And by doing that, we're preventing tissue from dying directly, especially if there's a blockage in blood flow acutely.
And I've heard, and maybe you can confirm this, that while it is useful to get in there early with treatment when precisely the stroke is occurring, it may be helpful even to undertake the surgery a little while later, because there's this phenomenon of the penumbra. I'm sure you're familiar with that, this area
of
brain tissue that's not dead, but devitalized, stunned, has the potential for recovery, but has been damaged. Tell us about that.
Sure. So that's interesting you mentioned that, because the Israelis, along with looking at how patients did clinically, they also use something called SPECT scans, S-P-E-C-T, which are a type of functional imaging of the brain. So MRI scans and CT scans are a static image of the brain. They're basically just the brain in time. They're not looking at the metabolic function of the brain at the same time. And what a SPECT scan does, and there's also functional MRI scans that do the same thing, they're actually looking at the metabolism, how well cells are metabolizing glucose, actually. So what the Israelis did is that they put all these patients in the SPECT scanner before and after hyperbaric therapy. And before, when they had these strokes, they looked at them on the SPECT scan. There was a large area, like you mentioned, around the area of tissue death from the stroke that was hibernating, or also called the ischemic penumbra, also called, in traumatic brain injury, another type of disease that we treat, the pericontusional area. So they checked it before therapy, and they checked it afterwards. And there was a dramatic improvement in the blood flow within that area. And that's where the actual correlation to their improvements in cognitive scores actually correlated together. Where those improvements were on SPECT scan, it correlated to where their improvements in cognitive scales and cognitive scoring improved on actual objective testing. So it was a pretty remarkable study for that reason, because we saw such a significant improvement in that ischemic penumbra, in the tissue that was not necessarily dead from the stroke, but just not functioning at its optimal capacity. Giving it oxygen, allowing those cells to regenerate, to make energy, that's what we do in the hyperbaric chamber. We're also increasing the blood vasculature around that area to support that in the long term, so it allows it to continue to be vital and continue to work in the long term.
So what would you say to somebody who might be listening, who experienced a stroke within the last year, has not undertaken hyperbaric oxygen therapy? Is it too late to undergo therapy in hopes of an improvement?
No, I don't think it'd be too late. I think that what they noticed in the study was that 6 months to 3 years was the study clinical design, and they noticed that people who were closer to the 6 months did better, but everybody did better. And that's been my experience. And this, again, this is an investigational indication. It's not covered by insurance at the moment. So, I mean, that's something to be considered, and we can talk about cost a little bit if you like in the end. But, at the same time, there was definite improvement in patients that were a year out. And I think this is what we've been seeing in a lot of different indications, a lot of different investigational indications. The closer you are to the actual event occurring that brings you to our office, usually the better that you do. But still, even if it's a little bit further out, we do see significant improvements in patients as well.
Okay, well, this is a good point at which to pause, because we divide our podcast into two parts, but this has been a very exciting introduction. We barely scratched the surface of the potential of hyperbaric oxygen therapy, and we've got lots more to talk about, so we will ask you to listen to us on part two of today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. We're talking to Dr. Scott Scher, who is medical advisor to Hyperbaric Medical Solutions. They have a website at logically enough, hyperbaricmedicalsolutions.com, and they have locations in Manhattan, Woodbury, which is in Nassau County on Long Island, and also in Medford, New York. That's also on Long Island, correct?
Yes, it's a little bit further east.
Indeed. All right, so let's pause. And when we return, we're going to tackle such conditions as chronic Lyme disease. We can talk about neurological disorders like Parkinson's and dementia, and some of the other fascinating applications of hyperbaric oxygen therapy. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.